I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object.
Cut the f***ing music!
Damn right, we got a tribute for the late, great Dick Dill, surf rock guitar legend. Now hit the music! Dill, the king of the surf guitar, has passed on to the great waves of the beyond. He is perhaps most known for his signature single, Miserloo, known to many as the theme song of Quentin Tarantino's cult classic, Pulp Fiction. Dill experimented with non-Western musical skills and reverberation. Being left-handed, Dill was known for his unorthodox playing style, essentially, in effect, playing his guitar upside down. He created an innovative style in the process and was without a doubt one of the founding fathers of surf rock. Additionally, his revolutionary experiments with guitar amplifiers meant that Dick Dill knew how to bring the noise. Dick Dill, in other words, was a force of sonic fury. Just check out his track, Nitro, if you need any more convincing of that. Dick Dill will go down as a musical legend, and this episode of Parallax Views is dedicated to him. Dick, catch some monster waves in the sky, brother. On this edition of Parallax Views, the news vandal J.P. Satilli joins us to discuss the Mueller probe, the college admissions scandal, the rising tide of Islamophobia in America and Europe, and the Christchurch terror attack in New Zealand, along with much, much more. JP is a two-time Emmy Award-winning producer and a gumshoe crack journalist. You're not going to want to miss this conversation, folks, so let's get right to it. The news vandal, JP Satilli. Welcome back to Parallax Views, JP Satilli, the news vandal.
How you doing, JG?
I am doing good. It has been a wacky few weeks in the news, and that's why I knew I need to have you back on the show. The first thing I wanted to ask you about, if I could, was this whole Mueller probe seems to be wrapping up. A lot of people, as far as I can tell, are losing faith in the Mueller probe. What is your take on this whole matter?
Well, there's this poll, this USA Today Suffolk poll, that found that 52% said they have little or no trust in the president's denials, right? But basically, that's half saying that they think it's likely a witch hunt. So it's such a strange thing, because Mueller has been so quiet throughout all of this, which is as it should be. Unlike when you had like the Star probe, right, of the Clintons, he was out there speaking all the time. So people had a better sort of read or handle on what was going on. I don't know if we have a great read or handle. And the indictments that have come down, there hasn't been that big juicy indictment, you know, that thing that says, here's connecting point A to point B. There we have it. We have a conspiracy, because Giuliani and, of course, Trump have done an amazing job of making it all about, is there a direct smoking gun link between the election of Donald Trump and the influence of Russian active measures? And, you know, as I've said a number of times, if Mueller's got the goods, if he has that connective tissue, I think Trump is toast. I think the GOP will abandon him. I wouldn't even expect him to be running in 2020, because they would love to default to Kasich or Nikki Haley. I think this is also, by the way, another reason why Pelosi wanted to take impeachment off the table. One, they probably done internal polling already that showed a similar result to this, that half of Americans think that this is likely a witch hunt, agreeing with the president, which is not good politics. And on the other hand, you probably want to run against Donald Trump in 2020 and not have him forced out of office, give the Republicans the opportunity to run against the Democrats as people who usurped the will of the people by removing a sitting president, and then have to face somebody like Nikki Haley and Kasich, who would do much better, I think, than Trump in some of these key areas where Trump was able to squeak out a win, particularly in the Rust Belt. So the messaging obviously has been effective. And I think, you know, the fact that somebody like Michael Cohen is the guy who's kind of become the face of this investigation, when he's actually more tangential than he is, more tangential to the Mueller probe part of this than he is to the Stormy Daniels stuff and the other payoff stuff where he's a prime player. I think that's also worked against the perception that Robert Mueller is onto something and doing good work and is going to come to a result that's going to be fair and equitable, because Cohen is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a sympathetic figure. So, you know, it's still a wild card, JG. We haven't seen the report. I have this guy. I'm sorry to go along this, but I have this guy who's been kind of trolling me for 2 years on QAnon and trying to convince me of QAnon and trying to convince me about the Mueller probe being this deep state conspiracy and all of this. And I say, you just got to wait for the report. You just got to wait for the report. I'm not going to say anything and make a report. Get a report. Get a report. 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 We don't even know if we're going to see the report. But that report is ground zero. And if he doesn't have something in there that shows some connective tissue, I think the likelihood of Donald Trump's election increases exponentially, and I think this poll is a canary in that coal mine.
Well, the only two, there were two things I was going to add in that regard. You know, I get why people can get very critical of someone like Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, but I also understood where Greenwald was coming from in terms of saying if we focus too much on this Russian collusion scandal and nothing comes out of it, that is going to be very, very, very bad for the left and for Democrats. The other thing I was going to mention is, you know, people can be mad at Pelosi saying impeachment is off the table, but you have these Trumpkins that are already primed for their president to tell them, I will not respect, you know, an election result where I lose. He said that before the 2016 election. Imagine what would happen if they tried to impeach him. You know, you'd have a lot of Trump supporters that believe everything's a deep state conspiracy against Trump that I think would probably go a little bit crazy.
You think? That's probably that may be the understatement of what is a pretty wacky 2 week period filled with understatements. I think you're dead on, and I agree with you. I mean, I've been a little bit uncomfortable with some of Glenn Greenwald's stances on this. I think he goes too far in the other direction. But then again, I do see the point in managing expectations, because if this doesn't return, it's as you say, it could be a disaster, and it could ignite an upsurge of goodwill support for Donald Trump among people who might be on the fence, because they say, oh my God, he was right all along. And nothing would be more powerful for Donald Trump is to be able to say, I've been calling it a witch hunt from day one, and I was right. And that would be almost like a broader, a writ large version of evangelicals believing he's sent by God as the latter-day Cyrus the Great, right? It would give him almost a metaphysical sense of rightness that could be sold in an election that would which looks like it's going to be a tough election for him, all things being equal. But all things are not equal if Mueller doesn't have it. And so, yeah, it's kind of a dangerous game. On the other hand, you got to think, after all this time, are we just coming away with you know, perjury stuff? I mean, if that's all that Mueller's got, my gosh, it's terrible. The other side of it, though, is this, JG, is I think that Mueller is cognizant of the fact that one, he is going to be constricted by these bogus DOJ guidelines that say a sitting president cannot be indicted. I'm not a big fan of that at all. I don't care who the president is at any point in time, presidents should be subject to the law. They should be indictable individuals. That's to me, that's just a constitutional principle. So he is obviously operating within that. The other thing is that if he believes that, then he thinks that the only thing that's left is a political process, which is then I'm going to hand over this report, and that's going to be sort of the setup for the political process, which is impeachment, which, as you point out, is a Russian roulette game, to make a pun, a Russian roulette game for Pelosi and the Democrats going into 2020.
Well, you know, I look around me at the world I live in, and in America, I feel like we are living in the, as I've been calling it, the new gilded age. And I think Trump is a perfect representation of that. Trump is a guy who, you know, I think if it wasn't for his daddy, he wouldn't be where he was today. He is today as a businessman who went bankrupt multiple times and now is president. But this new gilded age is really coming to the forefront now, especially with the college admissions scandal. I haven't been able to keep up with it nearly as much as I've wanted to. Maybe you can give a brief primer on it for me.
Okay. So, and you know, it does match. And just to make a little bit of to finish that transition, you know, one of the costs of all of this obsession on the Mueller probe and the Russiagate scandal which is, you know, 24/7 on MSNBC, it makes MSNBC practically unwatchable, is that there are all of these other Gilded Age scandals that run in and out of the Trump administration that get no coverage, that would fell. There are half a dozen other Gilded Age style scandals that would fell another president. And I think one of the reasons he in a way embraces the Russiagate narrative is that it sort of misdirects from – it's a misdirection from all these other scandals. And, you know, you pointing out this college admission scandal, it is emblematic of all of these – what is it? It's rich people run wild, right? So in the case of the college admission scandal, this is what we got. Let me get to it. William Rick Singer. His name's William Singer, but he goes by Rick. I don't trust that already, but that's fine. I pulled a quote from a story that appeared today in the New York Times that I thought really kind of summed it up. This is Eric Webb, a father of two from Champaign, Illinois, who drove to Peoria, Illinois in 2012 to hear Mr. Singer talk about building children's brands and leveraging their talents and finding the schools of their dreams. He said he was well-dressed, well-spoken. He had a PowerPoint presentation. Well, hey, I'm sold, right? So, but let's get back to that one line there. Building children's brands and leveraging their talents and finding the school of their dream. Okay, so these are kids as brands, which is emblematic of the time, right? We have a president who is basically just an empty suit who is a brand, right? And he, in the case of Mr. Webb, paid $5,000 a year to get consulting from him. But that's just him. Over the course of 7 years between 2011 and 2018, Mr. Singer earned $25 million from parents to get them into the right schools. Now, to get into the right schools, what did that mean? Well, in some cases, it was just sort of consulting, right? But in a number of cases, it was using the side door to get in to a college. So you have the front door, which is you better have the SAT scores, you better have the extracurricular activities, you better have a great essay, you have to have the 4.0, the whole nine yards to get in, and you better be a great candidate on paper. That's the front door. The back door is, well, like the Kushner's. Kushner's dad, I think, gave $2.5 million to school. The school says, hey, you know, Jared wants to go to Harvard. Come on in, because dad gave $2.5 million. That's the back door. And so the super wealthy often use the back door, which is here's a wing built on the science building in the name of Mr. X. And Mr. X daughter gets into the elite college.
I don't want to take us off track, but I wanted to ask you about there's that new book coming out actually about Kushner and Ivanka now. I think it's called Kushner Inc. Have you heard of that?
I have heard of it. I haven't been able to pick up a copy yet because I'm
it's coming out tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, you can pre-order it, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
So I haven't even bothered doing that yet because I, being the strange guy I am, went back and reread Gary Sick's October Surprise for some reason and felt like I needed to. But I'll get that. Yeah, and this already it's not looking good in terms of the previews of what's in the book for Jared and Ivanka. Look, they're sort of classic examples of this. These are let's get back here for a second. I'm gonna get to the side door in a second. You made the transition from Donald Trump New Gilded Age, and you want to talk about the college admission scam. I pointed out that one of the things that's happened with the obsession with the Mueller probe is that we've not paid attention to all the other Gilded Age style scandals that involve the Trump administration. Guys like Wilbur Ross and what's been going on with the migrant detention program where hundreds of thousands of dollars are being funneled through all kinds of weird organizations, including a Christian adoption agency in Michigan that's tied to Betsy DeVos. There's a lot of weirdness up there. There are all these scandals. One of the things that got overlooked in this nonstop, incessant, 24-hour-a-day hand-wringing over the Mueller probe is the amazing autopsy that the New York Times conducted on the Trump family fortune. And you basically made an allusion to that when you talked about, you know, Trump wouldn't be anywhere if it wasn't for his daddy and his daddy's money. Well, all of that money was accumulated through what? Lots of scams, lots of grifting, lots of using public access to public funds and modulating the value of properties. You make them low when you have to file your taxes, your property taxes. You make them high when you're trying to leverage it to get loans to buy more properties. It looks like they had a fixer inside local New York government who would actually play ball with them and change property valuations for them, an appraiser who would change the property valuations. Then all that money gets handed off to Donald Trump, who, oh, by the way, getting $400 million, went into bankruptcy a number of times because he sucks at being a businessman. What he's good at is building a brand identity, which brings us back around to Mr. Singer, who is basically saying to these parents, we need to turn your kid into a brand, okay? Just like Ivanka has become a brand and Kushner has become a brand. And oh, by the way, Kushner comes from what? His father is a felon who was prosecuted and convicted by Chris Christie, which is why Chris Christie got pushed out as head of the transition, which is why, by the way, Flynn was able to remain in that position. And Flynn was put there by what? Recommendation of Ivanka and Jared. I mean, it's so fascinatingly interconnected. But back to this guy Singer, the side door that he was charging parents to access was, well, look, I can get your kid in through a couple of things. One, we can do some sort of front door branding work where we can hire people to change the SAT and ACT scores. We can hire people to change and accept. I can bribe people on the inside to accept faulty transcripts and GPAs. We can actually get people to take tests for them and all this stuff. There's all that sort of normal sort of scamola stuff. But then there was this other part of the side door was one way to get in is if your kid has an athletic talent. So what we'll do is we will actually Photoshop your kid's face on somebody who is rowing crew or somebody who is fencing or volleyball or, you know, most of these were those kinds of sports, the kind of sports you expect for somebody with a very hoity-toity brand. And they will get into the college through the side door, through this athletic side door, which, by the way, has another pernicious level because one of my hobby horses that I like to ride is the incredible level of scumbaggery in the NCAA and the way they use particularly young men in basketball and primarily football programs to generate billions of dollars for the NCAA, paying coaches often $1 million. Athletic trainers now are getting like $700,000 a year, $1 million a year. Some of them, there's a big scandal at the University of Maryland, and everybody's making a huge amount of money. ESPN, ABC, they're all making huge amounts of money off of the hard labor of these young boys, often pulled from underprivileged homes, who have only one way out of their dead end situation, which is to play football at the NCAA level. They end up often with CTE and injuries. Once you get cut, the college has no use for you. They have no liability anymore. You never got paid for what you were doing. You probably didn't get an education. I know you got a future of CTE ahead of you, and you never made an NFL squad. So there's sort of this other part of this Gilded Age equation where you have these white people who are branding their kids with the help of Rick Singer to get them into the side door using athletic programs to fill a spot that they don't really have the right to be in, not in terms of the meritocracy that these universities supposedly are. And at the same time, you have these young African, often African American boys being brought into these programs to work essentially as laborers for a multi-billion-dollar system, and then they're discarded. I mean, there's so many disparities here. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go off on a tangent here, because I know you want to get back to Mr. Singer, who at one point left his home in Sacramento. I think this is around 2011, divorced his wife and left his home in Sacramento to go buy a really nice house in Newport Beach for $1.55 million. And Mr. Singer, who himself is starting to become a celebrity among the celebrities, which is all part of this celebrity Gilded Age culture that we find ourselves in, he establishes a foundation. Oh, how does this sound familiar? Let me read this. The foundation's tax returns show that it received more than $7 million in contributions from 2013 through 2016, $2.7 million in donations of that distributed in the same period, mostly universities. What happened to the rest of the money? Well, we don't know. It turns out that he had what looks like the investigation is ongoing, maybe a bogus foundation that he was using for his own means, his own purposes. Where have we heard that before, JG? Right? Huh. That's that. How unusual. One of the donations, $150,000, went to DePaul University while his son was an undergraduate there. Well, what do you know? Gosh, sounds kind of like, you know, similar to what went on with the Kushners and Jared going to Harvard, right? So, and it's not just, we can talk about Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin, and I do want to talk about Lori Loughlin and this idea of influencers, but we're also talking about CEOs, Manuel Enriquez of Hercules Capital and former CEO of PIMCO, Pacific Investment Management Company, Douglas Hodge, another guy, William McGlashan Jr., an executive at TPG Capital. You notice this? Investment management, TPG Capital, Hercules Capital. Is there a common denominator there too, JG? I mean, I know people might get a little bit bored with this college admission scam thing, but I think there's something just emblematic about this point in time in American history. And it's the college, the race to get into the best colleges is itself part of emphasis on celebrity-style branding of oneself and one's children, where the children become accoutrement of one's own brand. Because I think for the Lori Loughmans and the Felicity Huffmans of the world, and for these people at these investment bankers, it's not just about giving your kids privilege. It's about the privilege and the branding that you bestow on your kids with the help of this guy, Mr. Singer, also reflects upon your own personal brand as a parent.
It's fascinating to me because I think people haven't really looked at this college admission scandal. You know, the first thing I hear people say is, well, you know, colleges are for-profit businesses. And, you know, what's wrong with people leveraging colleges with donations to get their kids in? Which I don't think is what the scandal is about anyways. But that in itself, to me, is still a problem systemically with our society. We either live in a meritocracy or we live in a, you know, rule by the 1%. I just don't get why people can't face the facts on these matters.
Well, it's also emblematic of something deeper, which is the degradation of the American educational system as a public good. And there was a, you know, there was a time when a high school diploma meant something. And over time, a high school diploma has meant less and less and then become meaningless. And in the 90s, Bill Clinton said something. I want to make college education as ubiquitous as a high school education, as universal, he said. I love the word ubiquitous. I believe the actual phraseology is, I want to make a high school education as universal as college education is universal as a high school education. And at the time, I turned to somebody and I said, it'll be as universally bad as a high school education then. And one of the things that you see over time is that the marker for what it's going to take to be successful keeps moving. And it's kind of like it's a carrot on the end of a stick that's attached to a treadmill. And so instead of getting a high school education, being able to get a job, well, our economy can't do that now. Now you got to do something more to get a job. Okay, well, you got to go to community college and, you know, get an associate's degree or get a degree in welding or get some kind of technical degree, something that'll get you there. Okay. No. Now you got to get a 4-year education. Okay. We get a 4-year education. Well, now you got to get a graduate education. Oh, okay. Well, I got to get a graduate education, or you got to get a four-year education from a top school. And if you don't get a 4-year education from a top school or a graduate education from maybe a top 35 school, kid, you got no shot. So what do? We say, here's the carrot on the end of the stick. Okay, kid, you got out of high school. Get on this treadmill. Well, what does the treadmill do? Well, Forbes recently had an article. We're talking $1.5 trillion in student debt that has been acquired because kids get out of high school and they go, oh my God, I can't go to a community college and do this. I can't even go to a state school and do this. I've either got to go to one of the top schools or one of the top 35 schools. So I got to pursue that, because the only way to make it in America now is to be part of the elite, to go to an elite school where the elites are, where I can hobnob with the elites and I can get that elite imprimatur on a piece of paper that says, hey, I'm certified that I'm going to get a job. I'm going to go into massive amounts of debt because I can't get in the back door. And I don't have parents who can afford to do the side door. I have to go through the front door. And the front door means I got to bust my butt just to get all of the I's dotted and the T's crossed on my college application. And then I've got to go into a massive amounts of debt, which basically turns me into a debt slave for probably 20 to 30 years of my life. Also, I can be part of the elite.
Well, I was going to add there for a second. You know, people talk about the elite universities, and you know what people don't seem to understand, and it's the dirty secret of places like Yale and Harvard, is I believe it's around 60% or higher, possibly, basically are there as legacy students.
Yeah.
Their parents went there. It's you know, how many people have to get screwed just because they didn't win the birth lottery?
And I will give you another little dirty little secret, because I have a very, very good friend who is a college admissions counselor. And this person is a very ethical college admissions counselor. I spent time talking to this person over the weekend because I really wanted to prep. And according to her, she said that the dirty little secret about the elite universities is one of the reasons they have a high graduation rate, which increases their scores on the U.S. News and World Report yearly 10 best colleges and 20 best colleges thing. They have intense grade inflation. Some of them don't even give out F's. They don't give out any F's. So what that does is it increases the overall GPA. They never give out F's. They do everything they can to make sure the kids graduate. Most kids tend to graduate between 5 and 6 years. At the elite universities, it's between 4 to 5 years, and many of them closer to 4. And she says that's because once you get in, it's not that the schools are hard. It's actually that they make the schools easier. They make the coursework easier because they're trying to push them through to inflate grades. It's actually very similar to something that happens with home prices at the school district level. The better the school district, the higher the home price. So the question is you have these school districts where kids are doing really, really well. Are they doing really, really well because the kids are doing really, really well, or is it that the standards are being lowered to increase the performance of the kids and thereby increase the home prices of the people who go to live next to those schools? Am I saying that there's the scams are everywhere? Yes.
Well, it's deeply systemic. This is how our neoliberal society operates now, where everything is about the bottom line. It's all about money. Yep. There is no sense of public good. Everything is, oh, the private sector can provide for everything. It's all about the money. And you know, there is no sense of any kind of public good anymore. And this is where we're at now because of that.
I would say, you know, America is kind of the tale of two Friedmans. If I was to write a novel about a great American novel, it would be Dickensian, of course. And it's the tale of two Friedmans, Milton and Thomas. Right? Milton gave us the idea, particularly in the early 70s and the mid 70s, that was glommed on. He's really the father of neoliberal economics in America. That became a sort of a core principle of the Reagan years, because he was Reagan's favorite economist. And it's the idea that the bottom line is the only line. And it's the only line you can't cross. You can cross any line as long as it increases the bottom line, because you as a CEO have a moral responsibility to maximize profits for shareholders. How you do it, whether it's externalizing, if you can externalize the cost of creating a poison, right? And man, if I follow all the regulations here, my bottom line in creating poison X is going to be lower. So what I'm going to do is find a way of externalizing the cost of making the poison. And if some community somewhere that doesn't have those regulations, right, if I can find that one place where I can build my plant and people die, it doesn't matter. Am I making a profit? Did my profit increase? That's the only moral good there is, and that's creating profit and maximizing profit. Then you have Thomas Friedman, who became the sort of the latter-day apostle of this during the Clinton years, when the neoliberalism that Milton Friedman and Ronald Reagan enshrined in the United States was then caught – was or not enshrined, was introduced to the United States. It was then codified by Bill Clinton and Thomas Friedman.
Right. The third way in a lot of ways. It's the American version of what in Britain was called the third way.
Right, right. Well, if you think about it, it's sort of perfect because Thatcher brings in monetarism, and all monetarism is a British version of supply-side economics, which is basically a version of Milton Friedmanism. And then Tony Blair codifies that, right, after a lot of backlash to the austerity of monetarism and all of the job cuts and the displacements that happened in the 80s in Britain. Then you get Tony Blair and New Labour, right, which then codifies it from the left, what was began on the right. And the same thing happened in the United States. Milton Friedman, Ronald Reagan, and then there's a lot of backlash. People forget about the big recession during Herbert Walker Bush's presidency and the savings and loan scandal and Black Monday, all that stuff that happened. There's a lot of economic fallout from the Reagan miracle, as it was called, a miracle that didn't really last that long because it was basically a sugar high. So then you get that codified by Bill Clinton, and the apostle of that, the earth is flat, globalization is a good, no two countries with McDonald's have ever attacked one another. That's why we need to have McDonald's everywhere. If we could just get a McDonald's in every country on the planet, we would have world peace, according to Thomas Friedman, right? So this is all part of an overall idea that the ends are almost always justified by the means. And that's where we are in America. The end justify the means.
Well, I was going to say, too, you know, and we're veering off topic. We'll get back to the college admissions scandal. But I have to say, Thomas Friedman is one of the most infuriating people on the planet. And it's not just because he is wrong. It's because he is wrong and he is still afforded a social status job, a high social status job, writing columns. And you know, it doesn't matter how many times he has been wrong about everything. He still is allowed to just spout his opinions, his inane garbage, and still be part of, you know, the hoi polloi of society. It's a huge scam.
And it's not just like afforded social status. It's reverence. It is reverence. If you watch him go on one of these gab fests with the Blatherati, put him on Meet the Press, for example, on a Sunday, watch the reverence with which he is treated. And I think it's because it's comforting, right? It's comforting to have somebody who says, "Oh, I've gone out there, and now let me interpret all of the changes for you and show you how it's all really start." It's still part of an overall story of American exceptionalism and positivism, that we're still making progress, and that America is still exceptional, and it still is an idea, and all that, da, 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 da. And, you know, by the way, speaking of exceptionalism, I think that let's bring it back around to the college admission scandal and this parenting. I think, in a sense, American exceptionalism writ large is echoed in my child's exceptionalism in miniature, right? It's American exceptionalism in miniature to say, look at how exceptional my child is. My child, look at this brand that I've developed for my child. My child is an influencer. My child went to Harvard or Yale or went to Brown. Oh my, look at my kid. My child is a trophy. My child is an example of how awesome I and my family have become. I mean, it's...
Are you familiar with Edward Luce? He wrote a book called The Retreat of Western Liberalism, or maybe it was The Retreat of Western Democracy. But he's been on this line about how the elite in our society today, they believe that they are part of a hereditary meritocracy, which I think Luce is, of course, being a bit cheeky when he says hereditary meritocracy, because it's an oxymoron. And I'm just fascinated because I think these people like Lori Loughlin, they think their kid deserves it. It doesn't matter if they didn't work for it. Just by virtue of who they were born to, they deserve it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Well, there is a wild card here, though, which is it's not as hereditary as it once was. It's a little bit more wide open. If you are willing to go full Milton Friedman and, for example, with the Kardashians, exploit a sex tape that your daughter was in. So, you know, who's the latest Kardashian that made a billion?
Kylie Jenner. They keep calling her a self-made billionaire, and I want to just punch a wall every time I see self-made billionaire by her name. It's absolutely disgusting.
Exactly. And there is the point. That Kylie Jenner and oh my God, what are the names? I had to write it down because I've tried not to keep these things in my head. I know it's Olivia, right? No, yeah, Olivia Jade and Isabella Rose, the Laughlin girls, right? Who are influencers, who are following in the footsteps of Kylie Jenner, who is following in the basically is following what? Not in the footsteps. She's riding on the back. Literally on the back of her sister, who became famous because of a sex tape, who her mother admitted was, you know, yeah, we were okay with that.
Well, did you hear what Kylie Jenner said? She was saying, you know, my parents cut me off at 15. I worked to get where I was at. I'm just thinking to myself, you know, if you were born poor and you didn't have the safety nets you had, you'd have a much different experience of life. And just the audacity of these people.
Well, the other thing that poor people don't have is access to a reality show family. And so here we are again, back to this celebrity machine that has given us a president who I think is the most representative president. If we have a representative democracy, he is representative of the state of this democracy. He is our representative president. We've never had a more representative president than this in my lifetime. He is us. That's who we are. Callow, intellectually flatulent, D-lister celebrity who is willing to do and say anything to make money and be famous, because being famous is the ultimate end. And so here's another weird aspect of all of this, because, you know, how much of this is really about making a lot of money in the long run, and how much of it is about sustaining oneself as a brand and celebrity with access who can be in the hoi polloi with all the movers and shakers and beautiful people? Because I think that's a big part of this as well for a lot of these people, is that it's about elevating their kids' brand to be one of the brands among the other brands that everybody is looking to as influencers with followers. One of the funny things about this is that I think over time, as neoliberal economics has stopped generating actual upward mobility for a large number of individuals, as the middle class has been slowly dissipated, and as the economy has become more divided between haves and have-nots, as people have become more enthrall to debt, as we become debt slaves, as we've found ourselves on treadmills, and as we've reached what I think is an era of peak stuff, where there's really not a lot of stuff that people can buy to make them happy anymore. I mean, if you look at what tech is really it's two things. It's disruption, which is let's find a business model. Let's disrupt it. I'm doing air quotes, folks here, which means let's find a way to crack it open so that we can insert ourselves as a middleman and collect a rent on everything. That's one side of it. The other side of it is let's just keep going to version 2.0, 3.0, 4.0. Let's just find a new way to take a widget and dress it up a little bit more and make it look like new improved. It's just new improved Tide. New improved Tide with extra whitening power. And next year we'll have extra, extra whitening power. That's what every new iPhone is, right? Basically, it's because they have to generate wants and desires among a population of consumers that I think has grown weary of consumption over time.
Well, that's why we have things now like there's that new dating app called The League, and it's only for elites and like upper middle class people. Yeah.
There you go. Right. Because we have a hole basically in this neoliberal economic system in our souls. As the common good has been replaced by the ends justify the means and the bottom line being the only bottom line and the tale of two Friedmans, we have a hole. And how do you fill that hole now? We have been offered D-list celebrity as a salve for that hole in our souls. And we are stuffing it with this chase for elite status and celebrity. This is, cracks me up about people complaining about Facebook. All Zuckerberg did, and to the same way Twitter has done the same thing. But all Zuckerberg did is say, I'm going to take your narcissism and I'm going to weaponize it and I'm going to use it as breadcrumbs to draw you in to my panopticon. And we walked into his panopticon willingly because people were giving us, little hearts and thumbs up for a meal we ate yesterday. We are chasing the same kind of branding and the same kind of celebrity, sort of callow celebrity, that Lori Loughlin was trying to give her daughters, that the Kardashians have been chasing. We in our own way are all chasing it on Facebook every day.
Well, each and every one of us, we could be the next Cash Me Outside girl. That's the big dream,
right,
in the age of neoliberalism.
That's it. That's basically it. And I think that it's sort of a great, if people are interested in the details, you can look up the details. The New York Times has good coverage on this. There are a number of good stories. If you type in the college admission scandal, I've kind of given you sort of the rough outlines of it, which is basically, this guy was hired to cheat on behalf of kids to get them into school positions that they weren't supposed to be in. By the way, there was also Joe Montana. Who's the golfer? I always forget the golfer. I'm not a big golfer guy, but Joe Montana was one of his clients. Now you have students at Stanford who are now suing because they say that their education has been devalued by this, by Stanford allowing this to go on, which I think is itself sort of a meta level sort of irony to all of this, because they were going there to not get educated. They were going there to have what? A certificate that said, I'm elite. And that's kind of the sad part of this, because I could tell you if I had gone to an elite school, it would have been about the education, right? It would have been about going and get education. I didn't go to elite school. I actually wasn't that interested in going to elite school because I was interested in getting educated. That's actually, as long as I was getting educated, I was happy. And so I talked earlier about the slow decline, or maybe not so slow decline, of public education in America, which has then created this rat race to try and get into elite schools, because the education that we give to young people in the United States at the grade, middle, and high school level is failing. It doesn't allow them to begin to live a life once they're completed with their education. Why? Because it's not good enough for the economic environment that's been created by this financialized neoliberal system. So if we were to actually get back to the process of educating people, wouldn't it be ideal if people came out of high school at age 18 with enough of an education where they could actually make a decent living in America? I mean, that's actually another part of this, is that as the bait and switch that has drawn people into this debt slavery of student loans and this rat race of trying to become elite or become celebrity or become the next Cash Me Outside girl, this is, it's all part and parcel of the same rot that is that has created surveillance capitalism. Surveillance capitalism is just the latest part of it, where we've all become commodities who have been basically drawn into a panopticon out of a desire to become the same sort of celebrities that we see trying to preserve, hand off their own access to celebrity to their own kids by branding them erroneously, falsely, and maybe maliciously with Rick Singer to get them in a side door into a college that they have no business being in, which, oh, by the way.
Well, this also connects to SAT and ACT tests, right? Sure. Wasn't there bribery there too?
Yeah, there was bribery there. There was bribery there. You had bribery of coaches.
I mean, were they faking test scores?
Yes. They were faking test scores and transcripts, and they were bribing people in the admissions offices.
Right. This wasn't a simple matter of, I'm just going to give you guys some donations, which to me is legal but bad enough as it is. This goes much deeper.
No. This is a full-on scam. Full-on. On every level. And you know, this, you got 50 people with legal exposure on this. This is big. I think it was called Operation Varsity Blues, which I got to hand it to DOJ. That's kind of fun. And I guess it was the Massachusetts Attorney General who issued the initial indictments. And I think it's going to continue to grow. And this guy Singer, oh, by the way, to make it sort of perfect for the time, he participated once he got confronted by authorities. He participated, and he wore a wire, and he would get on the phone and goad some of these former clients into incriminating themselves. But even along the process of his cooperation, he was actually throwing roadblocks up. He was cooperating much in the way Manafort was cooperating for a while, right? Which was, he was kind of trying to run. He thought, if I cooperate, maybe I can manage my own exposure by hanging all of my clients out to dry, which is, makes it even better, even more emblematic of the age.
I was going to say, what fascinates me about this is, I was talking to one of these soccer moms yesterday about all this, and they didn't really know about it. They were just sad that Lori Loughlin got fired from Hallmark, and now, boo-hoo, I don't get to see my Lori Loughlin Christmas movies or garage sale mysteries. I liked Full House so much. And I just said to him, I was like, you know, what about those kids and their families that got screwed over by this? And, you know, what they said to me was, well, you're trying to make the world into a utopia. I said, no, I don't think utopia is possible. But that's not the point. 30, 40 years ago, I don't think people would have stood for this bullshit.
No, they would not have. And that's
not utopian, to point that out. This is BS. And people are suffering because of it.
Well, I think this just – that anecdotal experience, I think, is not unusual. And I think it really strikes to the heart of the transition in America from sort of pre-Reagan to post-Reagan. I think the election of Ronald Reagan was a tipping point.
The movie star, Ronald Reagan, the B-movie star that was in crappy B-movies. But
right, which really, if you think about it, I wrote a piece for Consortium News with Trump's election right as he got elected, and I said Trump is basically a Ronald Reagan reboot on steroids. And I think the parallels are there. By the way, the first person to use Make America Great Again as a campaign slogan was Ronald Reagan in 1980. Type it in. Make America Great Again, Ronald Reagan. You will see the buttons and the posters.
Well, it's so bizarre where we are at, because you have people saying that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that Ilhan Omar, Rashid Tlaib, all of these young freshman women who I think are very brave, actually, they're getting called, they're far left, they're socialists. I mean, the centrists keep calling them far left, and I'm thinking to myself, back in the time of LBJ or FDR, they would have just been considered the norm. But we're so far off the beaten track at this point that now these people are considered extremists. They're not even socialists. They just believe in the idea of democracy. Instead of democratic socialism, you could even call it democratic capitalism.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in countering supply-side economics with demand-side economics. See, before Ronald Reagan, America was basically under the influence of Keynes, Milton Keynes, right? And John Milton Keynes. And that was demand-side economics. And I think that words matter. So if you think about demand versus supply-side, and supply-side is what we get with Reagan and the sort of Milton Friedman economics and the Laffer curve, which I think is one of the great nomenclature is destiny, sort of telling things that it was that his name is Arthur Laffer, the guy who came with the Laffer curve, who said, the more you cut taxes, the more revenue the government will get, right? The Laffer curve, which he wrote on a napkin, and became sort of a linchpin of Reagan's economic policy. And a guy who tried to implement it, David Stockman, at a certain point, who was the whiz kid who was going to implement this great revolution, he said it doesn't work, and was then cut free and excoriated. And he's actually become quite a vocal critic over the last 30 years of this kind of economics. What supply side economics basically says is, if you put all of the money in the supply side, if you weight all of the capital in the hands of capital, the people on the supply side who supply the market, if you empower them with money, they will invest it, and they will create tons of jobs and all kinds of tax revenue and all that.
Trickle down.
Right. That's the supply side. The demand side idea is, if you put money in the hands of those who create demand, in other words, consumers. So if you weight all the capital, the money, in the hands of the people who go out and do the buying, that will drive the market. And I make the argument that Keynesian capitalism versus Friedman-style capitalism, demand side versus supply side, is actually a far more democratic form of capitalism, because what it says is, we're going to put most of the money in the capital in the hands of the middle and working classes. They are going to in turn go out and, as the demand side, go out and buy stuff. And as they go buy things, the market will then determine what is created, and the market will actually work from a demand side, where people are going out and, in a sense, democratically casting their votes with the money they spend, and the market will give returns on those, just like election returns on voting. It will give returns based on how people elect to spend their money. The supply side is actually, if you think about it, much more like a centrally planned system, where a small elite, let's say in a communist economic system, a small elite group of people determine what the market will offer based on their ability to control the means of production on the supply side. And I actually I'm willing to make the case over and over again that supply side economics is much more like a centrally planned controlled economy that you would find in a communist system than it is a democratic form of capitalism.
Well, would you agree with my sentiment there on AOC, Omar, and these young Democrats, that the image of them as just being so far to the left is just way off base, at least if we're looking at it in the broader history of politics in this country?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not willing to. In terms of Ilhan Omar and Tlaib, I think that's a slightly different thing than AOC. I think Omar and Tlaib are actually the first. There are a couple in there. Ron Paul was for a while, and Kucinich was for a while. But now you actually have people who materially represent the impact of American empire over the last 70 years in Congress as critics offering a significant critique based on personal skin in the game, the impact of U.S. empire. So that's one of the things that I think sets them apart. And I think it's one of the reasons why there's so much backlash against them, because here you have two people who actually know what the impact of American empire and military policy has been on the ground. Okay. As for AOC, she says, yes, I'm a socialist. I'm a democratic socialist. That's, democratic socialism. Again, I could make an argument that democratic socialism is, in a sense, a version of demand side capitalism and Keynesian capitalism, Keynesian style demand side capitalism. Where her true heart is, you have to interview her on that. I mean, I think also one of the things that makes her a lightning rod is that she is assertive, young, female, Latina, attractive, and excellent at social media. And I actually think there is a lot of fear on, particularly on the right, and internally in the Democratic Party, they have their own thing they've got to deal with, because they're struggling between this idea of electability, the kind of thing that actually caused empowered Bill Clinton and the Democratic Leadership Council way back when, in 85, 86, 87, when it was founded and then took flight after Dukakis lost, when electability and moving to the center became the uber goal, the overarching goal, the only goal really of democratic politics. And Bill Clinton was the guy that was sort of leading that effort and became the standard bearer of it and won as a result of it, or he believes as a result of it. He actually won because of Ross Perot, but who was the only guy who was not acceptable in that election. Ross Perot was really dangerous to the system in 1992, and the system was much more comfortable with Bill Clinton than it was with Ross Perot, which is, that's a whole nother show. But, I think the Democratic Party is now dealing with its own internal Tea Party. I called this, the Democrats Tea Party last year when the off-year election and the congressional elections were getting underway, and you could see this thing bubbling up. And how they deal with their own internal Tea Party movement is going to be a fascinating thing to watch. I think Nancy Pelosi is trying to manage it right now as best she can, but there is a lot of energy in this democratic socialism, or this idea of returning to a type of democratic politics that is rooted in the New Deal and FDR, who, by the way, FDR was rooted in Keynesian demand-side economics, which is this idea that after years of financialization, the original Gilded Age, which then, gave birth to the progressive movement, but then, the progressive movement kind of got worn down or whatever, and we had this second sort of run financialization run rampant in the 1920s. And that was a form of supply side economics that made the 20s occur, that fueled the 20s. A return to Keynesian demand side economics that allowed FDR to create one of the most powerful political coalitions in the history of the Republic, which was this incredible political force that got him elected three times, and had he not died, getting back to that, I think, is probably more – that's why they – I think she's using the New Green Deal. It's about trying to bring back an idea of the New Deal and bring back – reunite working class and middle class peoples together in a coalition, because I do think this, JG, is that one of the great stories of the last 100 years is the concerted effort after FDR's death by a core of right-wing activists to dismantle the FDR coalition and divide and conquer the middle and working classes into two separate groups so that they could not vote as a bloc. Because when they vote as a bloc together, you see income inequality go the other direction, and you see the elites begin to lose power and lose their hold on on property and wealth.
Well, you know, I think this is a good way to segue into our last topic I wanted to cover.
Sure.
You were talking about the electability thing, and I'm going to actually tie this into the Christchurch shooting.
Oh, I can't wait to hear that. That sounds
so. People talk about the electability thing. I see all these never Trumpers, like David Frum, like Bill Kristol at the Bulwark, and Max Boot now trying to curry favor with Democrats. And I see places like MSNBC are hosting these never Trumpers. And you know what? I'm going to be honest. Someone like David Frum, I think David Frum he believes in what he says. I think he has good intentions, but intentions don't really matter in the world we live in. David Frum, Bill Kristol, all of these people, they gave us this war on terror where they painted Islam as the enemy.
Yep.
And they lost control of their own party. Their party was lost to a bunch of nativists, starting with the Tea Party and now with Trump. And I can't fathom. They've created this Islamophobic environment, and they act as if they have any say anymore in electability. I mean, these people have caused a major crisis with all of this. And you know what? I'm sorry, but I don't think David Frum's opinion matters anymore. I don't want to read his article in The Atlantic about his thoughts on immigration. He lost his party. His opinion doesn't matter. And someone needs to tell them that. I don't think anyone will, though.
I have three words for you on David Frum. Axis of evil. He is the author of that moniker, of that branding. Here we're back to branding. And I'm not going to disagree with anything you just said, because you know, look at Bill Kristol. He's not that different in a sense from Thomas Friedman, a man of many, many bad ideas, who is not treated with the same reverence of Thomas Friedman, but afforded a great deal of airtime in spite of his continual inability to get things right, and not just to get things right, but to actually, as you point out, poison the environment and create the matrix of nativism and Islamophobia that we are now seeing unravel in front of us and turn into killings and a massive rise. And sort of there's a double irony here too, because not only did the neocons and the people behind the war on terror create the kind of matrix that would that caused Islamophobia, that engendered Islamophobia, that promoted Islamophobia. They did that, but then also they got the United States involved in a war that created a backlash, and a backlash that Donald Trump exploited for his own purposes.
Well, yeah, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. I mean, we've seen trust in government going down.
Exactly.
At least the Nixon years. The Iraq War is the straw that broke the camel's back. You don't get Trump without the Iraq War and without rising Islamophobia.
Bingo.
You know, again, I want to say
this.
So
they're wrong on both ends of that equation.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
On both ends, they screwed it up. So
I want to say real quick, again, it's nothing personal. I don't have any, like, personal issue with a David Frum or a Bill Kristol. I actually do think they believe in this, like, liberal interventionist. If we just free up all the markets around the world, we'll all live in peace. I think they actually believe that.
Yeah,
but the matter at hand is they dropped the ball, and they need to be told that, and they need to admit it.
Well, and this is back to Ilhan Omar. Her confrontation with Elliot Abrams is one of the golden moments of the last 20 years in congressional politics. That attack on him, and it's not an attack really. I mean, that's sort of that's maybe not even the right word. That holding up of a mirror to him to show him who he was, and to have the audacity to tell the truth, I think actually cuts to something else that's part of all of this, which is that, you know, David Frum and William Kristol and them being out front and saying these things also in a way allows to absolve themselves as well, because if they can be rehabilitated, then we can be rehabilitated. Because I think, frankly, the American people have not come to terms with our complicity in the destruction, the wholesale destruction of a bystander nation under false pretenses, something that we all should be held responsible for. We should be paying reparations to Iraq right now by the billion. I mean, billions of dollars should be going into Iraq to say, oh, yeah, we're sorry. There should be a public apology. There should be prosecutions. None of that's going to happen. Why? Because even though trust in government has gone down, it's created a backlash. I think fundamentally still Americans are unwilling to accept the fact that we as a people are responsible for the destruction of another country under false pretenses.
Well, there's distrust in government, but people still want their, there was a book I read about the Trump phenomena. And it was called The Gilded Rage by Alexander Zaychik. And he would talk to these Trump supporters and they would say that they don't trust Bernie, but they like him. And then they would say things like, I don't like Obamacare, but don't take away my Badger care.
Sure.
And Zaychik was just like, they don't realize that they actually agree with a lot of these policies they call socialist. They want their Medicare. They want all these things. They just don't realize it because there's so much disinformation.
And that's, this thing I was talking about a few minutes ago about this concerted effort after FDR died to break apart the New Deal coalition. And that's where you see the New Deal coalition broken in two between blue and red. And as long as there is a wedge between the two parts of this New Deal coalition, and the wedge was what? Race and xenophobia. Starts with the Southern strategy. It starts with Nixon. It obviously starts a little bit earlier with sort of the implications of anti-communism and the blacklist and how Jews are controlling Hollywood and all that. Then it really gets into this after Brown versus Board of Education of using race as a wedge to drive it open. And Islamophobia was just the latest iteration of that wedge.
Well, I want to comment on that too, because in case anyone hasn't figured it out yet, one of the reasons everyone is going so hard on Omar is because of the way she dresses. And they don't like that this woman is openly proud of her culture and her religion. That's why a lot of people go after her. And we're living in this very tense environment. I mean, there was just one of these blue checkmark journalists that I had an argument with on Twitter.
Blue checkmark journalist.
Yeah. She said to me, she was saying that, now we have this congresswoman in office that's going to bring tick, tick, boom into the halls of government, implying that Omar is a jihadist. And I said to her, you know what? You're just an opportunist. And that's disgusting what you're saying. And she said to me, I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about ideology. I said, I'm not talking about any of that. I'm just saying you're an opportunist that is making wild and exaggerative claims that are going to lead certain people to think that their whole country is under attack by Muslims. And it's going to lead to violence. And lo and behold, a week later, look what happened in New Zealand.
Well, and let's take another part of that. Here is Ilhan Omar. She's Somali American. You know what people don't know because the news media is not covering it because of all the obsessive Mueller coverage? Is that the United States has killed like 60 Somalis in the last month with two major bombings. In one of the bombings, children were killed. Somalis are being killed by American bombs.
You know what else Americans don't know about? They say they don't want a Somalian woman in and Islam and blah, blah, blah. And I say to them, who were the 19 hijackers and who ate it and abet it on 9/11? And they say, I don't know. I say, Saudi Arabia, but they're our friend, right? Because they got oil.
Well, and that's the other thing. You know, when we've gone deep, we've gone all over the place. I try to remind everybody over and over again, when you get to the final analysis, Donald Trump's presidency, for all the things it is an oil presidency, folks. It is an oil presidency that has not changed. And oil has basically been the dominant force in American politics and life for 75, 80 years, maybe longer. But, you know, there's the post-war oil environment and the pre-war oil environment. I'm talking post-war and the assemblage of America's neo-colonial empire. It has been in the service of oil. It has used oil as its currency, oil as its power, oil as its fuel. And Donald Trump is still an oil presidency. Why you bring up Saudi Arabia? The price of oil essentially has doubled under Donald Trump. It has fluctuated from its high point of 85 or 86 about 9 or 10 months ago, and it's gone up and down, but it's still stayed high. And A lot of what you see in American policy is about controlling the flow of oil into the markets. It's not about going and taking oil. That's where Donald Trump has got the wrong end of the stick, but he's really a tool. He's not a Cheney-esque kind of scion of oil who is implementing policy. He is there to do one thing, and that's to destabilize the oil market, which he did with the Iran pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal. That was one of the things. Instability in the markets creates revenue. Instability creates revenue, folks. Put those two things together. Another thing that you do is you keep other people's oil in the ground and you limit their ability to bring it to market. See Libya, see Iran, see Venezuela. All of these things are hot spots under Donald Trump. Why? Because he is another oil presidency.
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. I wanted to say in regards to this Christchurch shooting.
Yes, Christchurch.
We've been trying to get to it, folks. Yeah, yeah. Me and JP go into multiple areas. That's what I like about these conversations. But what I was going to say is there's, to me, multiple aspects to this, especially with the way people are reacting to it. You have the neocons who created the environment that we now live in where people are afraid to go to places of worship because they could get shot by these crazy anti-Islamic terrorists, and they're not going to take any responsibility for that. You have these centrist Democrats, like the Pod Save America hosts, who are saying, oh, don't mention the shooter's name! Don't mention the shooter's name! And then you have the alt-weenies, who are now crying foul, saying, oh, we didn't want this to happen to innocent people! This is horrible! I'm thinking to myself, you guys are saying that Europe is being invaded. Europe and America is being invaded by an alien force called Islam. Well, yeah, what do you think is going to happen eventually? Someone is going to try to terrorize Muslims to get them outside of the country because they view Islam as an existential threat. And when you push that rhetoric, this is what happens. I want to know your take on it, though, man. Sorry, well, I'm fired up.
Yeah, I know. And this stuff, you know, I do get fired up, and maybe I was a little fired up when I wrote my a piece on it the day that it happened. I think the most important thing for me right now is that we don't hide this guy's manifesto, that we don't hide his face. I actually went I think I was watching coverage of it about 15 or 20 minutes after it went on the air on the BBC. I just happened to be up that night and flicking around. And I always go by touchstone is BBC World because I sometimes want to know what's going on in the world, because if you just watch American news, you know. And yeah, I think that's – so it was Sunday night. And so I went over there and they had said that he had posted the video. I went and found the video. It was on LiveLeak at that time before it got pulled, and I watched it. And it was tough to watch, man. It was tough to watch. I know that people are worried about copycatism and all that with the manifesto and his picture, or whatever. But then another thing is, if you make it secret and you censor it, you actually, in a sense, feed the narrative that a lot of these people participate in, that they're part of a secret truth, and that it's a dangerous truth. It's dangerous because it is true.
They have the Gnostic knowledge, right?
Yes, it's the Gnostic knowledge. Great term for that. And so I'm somebody who believes we need to open this up to the light of day. And look, if somebody's going to shoot, they're going to shoot whether this stuff is public or not, folks. Have you ever been to 8chan? Have you ever been to 4chan? What is it, GabNet? I've been to GabNet. Whoa.
Oh, Gab AI. Yeah, yeah. That's out of control. And I've been told that the owner of that is actually scared of the people that use that website, but he can't really do anything about it. You know, he wanted to make money off of it. Now it's just completely insane.
Yeah. JG, I don't really know how this is going to play out. I know it's likely to get worse before it gets better, because you have a president who says, I don't think white nationalism is an issue. He said he's right. They are invaders. He actually said that. He said they are invaders.
Well, that's the other thing. By saying that they're invaders, you by default are saying that the people that go to these mosques, you're saying they're not innocent.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, yeah.
Well, as I pointed out in my piece, I think there's just this amazing irony that a guy from Australia, a nation that was invaded by white Christian Europeans and taken from the same type of other peoples who he thinks are invaders, goes to another country where white Christian Europeans came and invaded to kill people who he says are invaders. And the reason he was – one of the reasons, the stated reasons, was because he wanted to spark a gun control-related race war in America, another country where white European invaders came and displaced people. So there's a fundamental lack of self-awareness that is built into this alt-right. Many of them are incels. I call it sort of the alt-right incel culture that's hermetically sealed off from reality. And as you said, participating in what they believe is their Gnostic truth, this secret Gnostic truth that they're part of.
Right. Where they think, my jawline isn't correct, therefore I can't get a girlfriend. It's all over.
Yeah.
It's insane.
So, which is mostly because they're, I have this saying I came up with a long time ago when I was doing my graduate studies on Nazism and fascism and comparative fascism, which is what my graduate degree was in, comparative fascism, is I think it's really funny that the people who advocate the strongest for a master race are the people, the last people you would pick to start a master race.
I can't disagree with that.
So, I mean, if you put them in a lineup, I don't know. And I think that there's something about that, though, is that they're participating in this thing called the human biodiversity movement, which is basically the latest iteration of eugenics. I see them writing on UNS Review all the time. I do the rundown.
Steve Siller, right? That's the guy that came up. Well, he popularized that term. The guy who originally came up with the term human biodiversity is like really angry. He says this is not what I meant when I coined that term.
Well, yeah, no, he had – well, that's because people started knocking on his door and coming at him. He's actually a geneticist, I believe, from the University of California at Davis. And people were knocking on his door and saying, hey, do you know about this? And so I think over time he's become more and more angry at being what he calls appropriated. But, look, we could do a whole other show on that, because I think that epigenetics is going to blow away the idea of biological determinism.
I agree.
But, JG, I don't know how this is going to play out, because there is actually – they've actually scored victories, and Donald Trump is there, and Donald Trump can dog whistle and bullhorn and send all the semaphore signals and keep people on board. And fundamentally, the division between – that wedge in the middle of the FDR coalition is predicated on exactly this cell, which is you are part of a group of people. You are under siege by people who want to take what you have. Good example.
Well, what was the name of the manifesto, right? The Great Replacement.
Great Replacement. Remember what they were saying at Charlottesville: Jews will not replace us. And that's actually I wrote about this at the time. This is part of a belief that Jews have a plan to replace the white working class with brown people, to eliminate the white people and drive them into extinction by replacing them with brown people.
I can't even fathom anymore what drives this. It's almost like they're mad that they, I think in your article you said, they're mad because they're getting a smaller silver platter than the ones their parents got.
Yeah. Well, I think there are two things. One, they feel dislodged and disaffected, and they have been dislodged and disaffected by the neoliberal economy. Let's be honest. You cannot – it's what I was saying earlier about education. We could tie this all together now. There was a time all the way into even the 80s. Even the 80s you could do this. It was dying in the 80s. But even into the 80s, if you were a white male in Indiana, you could get a high school diploma, you could come out, you could get a job at a GM factory, right? Or in Indiana, let's say you were in Elkhart, you could get a job working in, it's like the RV capital of the world. You could get a job building RVs, you could marry your high school sweetheart, you could have two or three kids, a dog, a fishing boat, a truck to tow the fishing boat, and a defined benefit pension plan that made sure that your retirement was going to be there and you would have health insurance. All with a high school diploma. Think about that. You can, right now, I have a graduate degree and two Emmys and I can't get that. So you see that they have been displaced. Now, the problem is who do you blame? Well, they're not blaming the people who are responsible, because people like Donald Trump say it's the Chinese who are taking your jobs overseas and it's the Mexicans who are taking your jobs out from under you. When actually the reason why the jobs went to China is because of Wall Street and because of corporate CEOs who wanted to maximize profits in a supply side financialized economy that was ushered in with the election of Ronald Reagan. So is there any coincidence that the people who ushered in the economic paradigm that dislodged this guy from Indiana from his future are then selling them boogeymen from overseas and from south of the border as the reason for their dislocation and not themselves the true culprits of the dislocation?
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a classic diversionary tactic.
And it's been going on for 50 years, and, you know, FDR by many was considered a traitor to his class. And the people who felt that he was a traitor to his class have spent many, many years and lots of money and lots of time methodically building up a movement. By the way, they're also using the evangelical movement for this. It's nativism, evangelicalism. They are using the levers. They are using the but there does come a point, JG, where we can say the people have been propagandized, and yes, I can trace it all out. But at some point, the people themselves have to be held responsible too. Because for all we could say about the internet, information is out there, and messaging is out there. And there does come a point at which people have to make a decision about who they are as a person.
And the society they want to live in.
And so if they want to live in a war of all against all, a sort of a doomsday prepper's paradise, then that's a decision they're making.
I wanted to say, I wanted your take on this. People have been saying, these alt-right people are like, well, why don't you focus on the fact that this shooter was also an environmentalist? I mean, he described himself as an eco-fascist. And I just say to them, listen, you always say, oh, well, what about left-wing terrorism? You always talk about right-wing terrorism. And I'm like, you know, the Red Army faction and left-wing terror groups, they haven't been relevant since the 70s. Ever since the 1980s, with the rise of groups like the Silent Brotherhood and the leaderless resistance that was promoted by white supremacists like Tom Metzger, and also these militia types, and people like Alex Jones, even though Alex Jones doesn't want people to know that anymore, that he promoted this leaderless resistance crap, they're just in complete denial about the reality of where this rhetoric ends. And I think it has to end in violence. I mean, if you believe that your country is under siege and you're convincing these wannabe McVeighs of that, they are going to resort to violence because they think that something is going to be lost if they don't resort to that. They can't trust their government. That's what they're taught by these crazy right wingers.
And they're also going to resort to violence because we live in an environment in which fame and celebrity has become the only brass ring available to those with nothing left to lose.
Well, that ties it into, right? I mean,
yep.
Olivia Jade, influencer.
That's it.
Christchurch shooting, influencer.
When you have nothing left to lose, and the path of least resistance is to become an influencer, it's ultimately everything comes down to this search for meaning. And I've seen a lot of people talk about try to explain fascism. What people, I think, miss on fascism when they put it into strictly materialist terms, that it's, you know, I've seen this often, all fascism is just another form of socialism. It actually isn't, folks. If you go deep into fascism like I did, what you find is it was a revolutionary movement, yes, but it was actually about, it was a revolution against materialism. It's about the sacralization of politics and turning politics into a political religion. And as such, it was about creating meaning for people in a post-Darwin world. And one of the ways you create meaning is by coming up with a metaphysical form of tribalism in which you are involved, you are part of a greater whole, a sort of biologically superior unit fighting for survival in a hero story. And that's really what leads to, I think, a lot of this violence, is that people have cast themselves as heroes in a heroic sort of Wagnerian epic. And it's about generating meaning in an otherwise meaningless life. And if you eliminate the common good and you eliminate the idea of a public good as a source of meaning in people's lives, they are going to search for other sources of meaning.
Well, on that note, I was going to add, if people want to really understand fascism, just go and read one of the proto-fascists, George Sorel, who started out as a syndicalist. But then Sorel was a big proponent of this idea of, you know, this masculine vitalism and the vitalism of violent men.
Yeah, it's called the Elan Vital.
Yeah, it's mythopoesis. This isn't about materialism. This is about creating a mythopoetic worldview.
Yep.
Where these people can find meaning through this war. You know, that's why they always talk about, oh, we're fighting Zog, we're fighting the Muslim hordes, we're saving the white race, 14 words. It's this disturbed, twisted fantasy that they create that gives their lives meaning.
Yep, it's a hero story. My entry point on a lot of that was through, I started with Italian fascism, and I studied the Giovanni Gentile. And he was the official philosopher of fascism, and he came up with something called actual idealism. And this is capital I idealism. This is Hegelianism, and that's where the roots trace back. And you know, Marx said Hegel was right, but he was standing on his head, and he wanted to turn him right way around. That actually the material is what drives it, because Hegel believed the spiritual drove human history with a capital H. And it really is about spiritualizing human activity. And what Giovanni Gentile believed in terms in his version of idealism was that the human being is only freed within the context of this of the heroic story of the state. And that's what these people are trying to create, is a heroic story of the state in which they become a constituent part of this great force in history as it pursues its epic, almost sort of Marvel movie, Avengers Endgame movie narrative.
It's like what Jordan Peterson says about maps of meaning. He's trying to create meaning for people.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I wanted to say real quick, if there's anything you wanted to plug or just a positive note to leave my listeners on, and then I'll let you go. I know we went over time. Thank you.
Okay, there is a positive note, which is if I brought up that FDR coalition, the reason why we are where we are is because this coalition has been divided and thereby been conquered. The question is, can the coalition be united again? Can the wedge be removed? And that's really where I think the fulcrum point is in the removal of the wedge. And when I look at the demographics, and just in terms of pure numbers actually tell a much rosier story than the anecdotal. The anecdotal is dire. The larger demographic story, where America is, because remember, in 2016, 5 million people the Democrats thought were going to show up did not show up to win. To deliver that win. They thought they were going to get 5 million more voters in that election cycle. And Hillary Clinton was a target-rich environment for the demoralization of that of those 5 million people. That's if those 5 million people show up again, Donald Trump has no way, no chance of winning, no matter who the candidate is. So I just, in terms of where things are moving, we're in a backlash phase. So the question is this the beginning of something, or is this the death rattle of something? Is this a reactionary movement? Is this a revolutionary movement? I think it's reactionary, but I think that there are tipping points where the reactionary can become revolutionary. It's just a matter of diligence. And I think one of the things that we have to do as individuals in this environment is begin to apply pressure to those sources of information that masquerade as honest brokers but are not honest brokers, because really what they are profit-seeking enterprises that are willing to be carnival barkers and red meat distributors because it drives profits. And it's up to us to eliminate the profits from the people and the organizations that deliver a lot of this tripe. I myself try to do my bit with the News Vandal Rundown. If you go to newsvandal.com, you sign up for the rundown. You're going to look at it. You're going to get this list. It's going to be divided into categories, and you're going to go, wow, I'll never read all those stories. Don't, because what I do is I take the headlines and I stack them so that if you just read the headlines and never click on a single link, it would take you probably about 6 minutes to read all of the headlines in order. You will find that the headlines actually tell a story. I call it a meta story. And if you just read the headlines in order, you will know more than your average cable news presenter. And I do admit that that isn't saying a lot, but it is saying something.
Well, hey, JP, I want to thank you again for coming on the show. Everyone check out JP's website, The News Vandal. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot, JG.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. Here's to you, Dick Dill, the king of the surf guitar. Hope you enjoyed my conversation, folks, with JP Satilli. Check out newsvandal.com. JP does some of the best news roundups, as he calls it, the rundown. Don't miss it, folks. He is one of the last crack journalists in America today. The real deal. If you enjoyed the show, please consider subscribing to the Parallax Views Patreon. We have a special episode coming up, part two of my conversation with former Roger Stone associate, Robert Morrow. Not going to want to miss it, folks. And if you can't subscribe to the Patreon, well, share, like, comment, get the word out there about the episodes you've heard, if you've enjoyed them. Get it out there, folks. I need you. You're the ones that make this possible. Get the word out on social media about Parallax Views. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it. Just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.